Welcome to This Human Life with the Philosophical Coach. I'm thrilled to have you tuning in. I'm your host, Sam Kilgathis, aka the Philosophical Coach, philosopher, Hume expert, and high performance coach. This podcast at its core is about navigating the complexities of being human, whilst providing you the opportunity to go beyond any conception of who you think you are really. Inside of the freedom that comes from not being attached to figuring out your true purpose or who you are is an opening for creating a life free from constraint. If that intrigues or excites you, then you're definitely in the right place. The ideas are drawn from neuroscience, philosophy, my coaching practice, working with elite leaders, and experience. You can expect candor, humor, vulnerability, and ideas which are unfamiliar to you, and some you may just plain disagree with. You'll also get the opportunity to hear from inspiring coaches and leaders. Now let's get ready to question what we know. Welcome back to This Human Life. If you joined us last week, I started to look at how language impacts the quality of our life. And in modern life, there's one word which we hear, which many of us use frequently day to day. When we feel like we're juggling multiple balls in the air, or when we feel like we're hammered with information left, right, and center, there's this tendency for it to create overwhelm. But why is there overwhelm? Let's look at that. When you experience overwhelm, what is there for you? What are the thoughts which are pervasive? Let me take a guess. I don't know how I'm going to get it all done. There's just too much on my plate. How am I going to get everything done? Have you ever had that thought? Have you ever felt like there's just too much to do? I don't know where to start. And then you're expecting your brain to provide you some sort of solution. When you're operating from this realm of there's too much to do, as if too much to do lives out in reality, as opposed to just in your speaking. Too much to do is just a series of linguistic expressions. It doesn't have an inherent meaning. Much ado about nothing doesn't have an inherent meaning. It's also a string of linguistic expressions, which inside of the way it's uttered, creates the meaning which we have given it. But yet there are words there in both phrases which have a commonality, much and do. But in one sense, too much to do is heavy and significant. The other, much ado about nothing, well, the other has almost no significance. It's like, why are you getting so worked up about that? What's the cost of you living your life as if what there is to handle is everything on your plate all at once? As if everything that you're doing has equal significance, equal importance. What if we are looking from, this is now. And now I'm creating what there is to do and handle in this moment. And then there is this other area which I'm not doing now. Why? It's not timely. It's not essential that I do this in this instant or do it today. So how do I determine this? Do I have to figure it out? No. That's actually the way I was operating when things were the least effective. When I'm trying to figure it out, overwhelm would persist. When I'm looking at what there is to do and handle, when I'm actually looking and seeing, okay, what are the different parts? Let me break this down. Let me write it down. And as I'm looking authentically at what it is that I'm now seeing, I then write it into existence. And then I break it into different areas of relevancy. This is now. And then after this is now, we have the next substrata of timeliness. And we break it down into what are the occasions which are needed to fulfill upon what you're doing now, such that overwhelm is not something which you experience. Imagine overwhelm was something you were just overhaving. And you're overhaving it because you're fed up. You're fed up with that being the existence in which you live. Who do you think you'd be if you got fed up with that? I'm going to speak from my own experience. You're going to be someone who can handle way more. Why? Because you don't live into this world called I am. I am overwhelmed. What are you doing when you're saying I am overwhelmed? You're creating your future. You're creating who you are. I'm overwhelmed. It's like going to meet someone for the first time and they've introduced themselves by saying, "Hi, I'm stressed." And you've responded, "Oh, hi, I'm overwhelmed." And then another person's gone, "Hi, I'm anxious." Someone else has said, "Hi, I'm depressed." And then two others chime in and say respectively, "Hi, I'm happy," and "Hi, I'm joy." It's as if that is actually who you are. You are these expressions of emotions. You are these different mental states which are arising inside of how you are perceiving your environment and the occurring world. No. What if you're over being overwhelmed and you declared, "I'm no longer going to be overwhelmed. I no longer even consider the phrase 'I am overwhelmed' to have any meaning. No meaning. Why would I even want to say it has no meaning when there's so much evidence that people get overwhelmed? Because it's not working. Why do you want to hang on to something which isn't working? Well, I'll tell you why, and you can look for yourself. It's working. It's actually working for you. What do I even mean it's working for you? Well, it's working in the sense that you get to keep the belief which allows it to persist. You get to keep believing that this is who you are. I'm overwhelmed. I get overwhelmed when there's too much to do. Rather than, that's much ado about nothing. And then taking actions consistent with the much ado about nothing perspective on life. We live in a world of heaviness and significance, and it kills us. And I don't just mean in a figurative sense. I mean, it kills us. We know how much stress contributes to disease and contributes to death when stress is perceived negatively. We know the proportions. There is a correlation, even causation, if you want. So it's killing us when we create all the significance about all the noise that's going on. We're inviting exactly what we don't want to persist. Now, sometimes people meditate to kill the noise as if that's what they can achieve. You know, they try to silence the inner critic. But how do you actually silence thought? It's a question. How do you silence thought? Can you silence thought? It's a challenging proposition to get your head around. It's common to think of there being no separation between our thoughts and who we are. The perception is that our thoughts are part of us. We are our thoughts. But if I was just my thoughts, then all of that is me. Now, something about that seems bizarre. I don't want to take on all my thoughts as me, but nor do I want to say that I don't have thoughts. Because on the one hand, the thoughts could be remedial. And on the other hand, the thoughts can be capricious or somewhere in between. So what matters? Well, what the evidence suggests or what experience suggests is that you have thoughts always. They're always there, even when you're not conscious of there being thoughts. And there's a difference between having thoughts and then figuring out what to say versus there being thoughts and you're looking and seeing and speaking into that. When you're getting your communication from others, where you're declaring something and creating it inside of your speaking, and that is generating the tone in which you speak. When I'm speaking, as I'm creating this right now, there's an aliveness because it's like I'm seeing something new. I'm not thinking about what I already know. It's just like, I'm in an inquiry to discover, like, what is the way in which my life has transformed? Now, I could point to different transformative learning that I've done, and that's been hugely valuable. But this is what I see. There's a massive distinction between doing transformative learning and seeing it as a course or a program versus actually living a life of transformation, where you're in an inquiry as a human being about who you are really, where the questions are where the excitement lies, where the discovery is to be found, where the challenges are to be met. And what I've learned from witnessing the different plethora of people who've undertaken transformative learning is the extent to which the transformation persists is really dependent on whether or not you continue to train yourself. If you think that training yourself ends when you step out of a course, then everything we know about the brain suggests that the effects of that aren't going to last very long. So what you see when you step into a new world has to be so poignant that you now never choose to go back to how it was before. You now see a different world. You're experiencing that world. You're present to that world. And you just want to keep discovering that world. You want to keep discovering the richness, the textures, the excitement, which lies in the questioning of what was previously so obvious. So obvious this is the way it is. So obvious this is who I am. It's so obvious that I can't find love. It's so obvious that I struggle with intimacy. It's so obvious that I won't be accepted. It's so obvious that I'm not a leader. It's so obvious that it's always my fault. All these beliefs are constructed. All these beliefs creating who you are really. But never questioning. Never questioning, is this actually who I am? Is this all there is? Now for a philosopher, it's your natural inquiry to question. It's what you're taught to do, to challenge everything. But that can take you on a pathway which can lead to something which also doesn't provide you access to transformation. It just provides you access to more of the knowing. And that might seem valuable. Because a lot of us, we strive for more knowledge. But we also know that knowing makes so little difference so often. There's so many things that we know which we don't put in place. We know we should go to bed earlier so that we can get more sleep. And then we find ourselves choosing to go to bed at a ridiculous time. And then we wake up and we're like, oh, I'm so tired. I haven't got any energy. We know that exercise is good for stress. And yet we're like, I don't have time for exercise. There's just too much on my plate and I'm really stressed. We know these things. And we act in ways which are contradictory or maybe even counterintuitive to that. What there is to see is that we act often in ways which are counterintuitive to what we know. They contradict what we know. So why don't we do that? Because the knowing isn't making the difference. It makes no difference most of the time. Can it be helpful to know things? Absolutely. But is it going to be the source of transforming something for you? No. Why? Because you already know it. How do you interact with something when you already know it? You might be smug. You might be sure. You might be certain. You might be right. And it's that word right that I want to focus on. Why do I say that? Because we operate as human beings from a context of wanting to be right. Believing we are right, wishing the other person would see what's right, do what's right, eat what's right. There's a righteousness to how we live. And then we justify our behavior because we say, well, this was the right thing to do. We justify infidelity because it was the right thing to do given I was chasing love with this person. We justify stealing, embezzling because it's the right thing to do given what I wanted to have or given the circumstances I was in. We just create right in all these ways which are counterintuitive. But they're intuitive to us or they're familiar to us. They're the patterns which have come to be our default ways of interacting. And when there's no questioning, then you're always right. Even when you don't think you're right. What do I mean? How can you be always right even when you don't think you're right? Because you don't think you're right. And you're right about the fact that you don't think you're right. And I share this because I had to see this for myself. I was working as a consultant and I was told, Sam, you have an answer for everything. And I responded instantaneously, no, I don't. What am I doing? Well, it looks like I'm validating this point of view, which is, Sam, you have an answer for everything. Rather than standing in that statement and questioning, do I have an answer for everything? I don't think I have an answer for everything. But what is it that is creating that perception? How am I interacting with this person, which is creating this perception? And then looking. Okay. Each time they speak, I say something to defend myself or to justify myself or to just respond because I think that's what I should do. But is that always what's called for? No. No, I could see it's not always called for. Sometimes I'm just speaking because I'm speaking. There isn't any point to the speaking. There isn't anything gained by the speaking. It doesn't bring forth effective communication. Now you've got to be in that inquiry. You can't just be like, oh, it's obvious. Oh, obviously I don't do that. No, I don't have an answer for everything. Who has an answer for everything? Now, it's not about the truth. I was looking initially at this as if like what was being said was the truth. Like this is actually what is so, rather than looking at How am I interacting such that their experience of me is that I have an answer for everything? Because if I recognize that this person is only getting the communication from me, not the other way around, their perception of me is based on how I'm interacting with them. Their listening of me, it's coming from how I'm interacting with them. Then there's an opportunity to create a whole new way of listening, a whole new way of communicating, which is distinct from that. And so I started to stand in the question, and in standing in the question, I started to discover, oh, I can see what it looks like for Sam to have an answer for everything in this context. And that knocked me back. It was a shock. It was a shock because I was coming from, no, I don't have an answer for everything. Now, this might seem a really opaque example, but what it speaks to is this distinction of righteousness. I was right that I didn't have an answer for everything. I was so right. And then I would reject it offhand without looking for myself, not questioning whether there was something to it. And here's what I see. This area of being right, it kills your humanity. It kills your power, your creativity, your freedom to live an unconstrained life. Because when you're attached to being right, you only get what you have. You only get what you already have. There's no opportunity to discover anything inside of being right if you already know you're right. So it's only in living into the questions that discovery becomes this access point for something new being created. So here's my question for you. If you've seen the impact that being right is having on living an unconstrained life, then where are you going to give up being right so that you can have more of what you want in life? And my invitation is for you to share with me what you see. Whether you're a relative veteran of this podcast or a new listener, I really thank you for taking the time to listen. And if you've got value from this podcast, then it would mean the world to me if you rate and review it on Apple or Podchaser and share it with your community so that this work can impact more people. Because I'm on a mission to help people live a life free from constraints. And if you're ready to take this from information to transformation, then connect with us at thephilosophicalcoach.com.